Hi, so I'm Liam. I'm in third year studying engineering physics. And today we're going to be reading from Exodus 19, verse 1 to 8, and then Exodus 20, 1 to 17. Okay, so Exodus 19. On the first day of the third month after the Israelites left Egypt, on that very day, they came to the desert of Sinai. After they set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, "This is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." These are the words that you are to speak to the Israelites. So Moses went back and summoned the elders of the people, and set before them all the words of the Lord who commanded him to speak. The people all responded together, "We will do everything the Lord has said." So Moses brought their answer back to the Lord. And in Exodus 20, verse 1 to 17. And God spoke all these words, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourselves an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your sons or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, so you may live long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Now let's pray for Tim as he comes down. So yeah, dear God, please guide Tim today as he talks about these passages, and please help him to talk from them faithfully. In Jesus' name, amen.
Well, I suspect if you ask the average Australian on the street or around UWA if they know about anything in the Bible, probably one of the top two would be the Ten Commandments. We've made movies out of it. Well, at least Hollywood made movies out of it, starring Charlton Heston. And in popular perception, I think it's probably almost the thing that people go to say, well, that's what Christianity's about. That's what the Bible's about. It's the Ten Commandments. And it's become so ubiquitous that we now have Ten Commandments about anything you want. I found Ten Commandments about how to have a clutter-free kitchen. Ten Commandments of cooking sushi. Do you cook sushi? I don't know. But there was one. Ten Commandments of being an artist. Ten Commandments of study. Ten Commandments of studying science. The Ten Commandments have become something you now use for everything. And I suspect for many people in popular perception, they perceive God as being someone who demands that people keep the Ten Commandments. They're not the Ten Suggestions, they're the Ten Commandments. If you want to be in God's good books, you've got to keep them. And most people think they do keep them. It's interesting, I remember a couple coming because they wanted me to marry them. And I explained that for me to marry them, it needed to be a Christian wedding. And they said, "Oh, we're Christians." I was a bit pushy. I said, So what's a Christian? They said, well, both of them actually said, well, Christian's someone who keeps the Ten Commandments. I said, okay, which ones do you keep? And they thought for a minute, and one of them said, don't murder. Yep, that one's right. The other one said, don't steal. And a smile. The other one said, don't commit adultery. And suddenly they looked at each other, slightly embarrassingly, and said, that one's difficult. There is that sort of perception that we do keep them, probably, if we knew what they were, but most of us don't actually know what they are. Amongst Christians, well, we just read them. If I asked you to recite them, they're on the board behind me. You can probably get most of them right. But in Christian perception as well, there is this idea that Christians are people who must keep the Ten Commandments, that obedience to God, keeping his commands, they're a perfect expression of God's will. So if we keep them solemnly, then that makes us Christians. But other Christians take the exact opposite tack. No, Christians are free to ignore the Ten Commandments. We're not under law anymore, but we're under grace. Two very different views of the law. Well, today we look at the passage where God gives the law, the Ten Commandments. This is the first time he parades them in the history of humanity. Israel has gathered around Mount Sinai on the Sinai Peninsula in the Middle East. And as we look at this, I want us to ask two big questions about the Ten Commandments. What's their purpose and what's their content? I won't do it in detail, but those two things will help us think about the significance of the Ten Commandments for us. Well, when it comes to purpose, I want to say that timing is everything. Timing's everything when you tell jokes, isn't it? Why did a man walk through Woolies through Coles with no clothes on? He thought he was in Woolies. Yeah. You've got to get the timing right. If you're launching a new product, a new app for the iPhone, you've got to get the timing right. If you get it wrong, it'll be a flop. Getting your assignments in, timing is everything. Asking that girl out, timing is everything. You've got to get in before the other guy. Or if you want the guy to invite you out, timing is everything. Exodus 20 comes at a timing. And two things are clear. The first thing is that the timing of the giving of the Ten Commandments are not before the redemption of Israel, but after the redemption of Israel. If you've been with us the last few weeks, or this semester really, we've been looking at this story of God's incredible redemption of Israel. This amazing liberation of hundreds of thousands of slaves under oppression in Egypt. But by God's power and might, by God's precision, he brings them out and liberates them. And it's all been God's work. Israel's been passive at best, often hesitant, unwilling to trust God, unable to obey God, grumbling and complaining all the way. But God didn't give them the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 1 and say to them, if you can keep those, I'll come to your rescue. If you pass my test, I'll give you what you want. If you do the right thing, then I'll do something for you. Now have a look at chapter 20, verse 2. It begins by saying, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of slavery. It's already happened. You are free. You are liberated. That is, to put it bluntly, Israel is saved for obedience, not saved by obedience, not saved because of their obedience. Now, this runs counter to so much popular perception and even our ingrained pride, I think. So it just keeps saying to us, if you keep the Ten Commandments, you'll be okay with God. It's a way of saving ourselves. Even if you're a Christian and know it's not true, it just keeps creeping back, doesn't it? No, they are God's people because God saved them. But God has saved them to be God's people, and that involves a relationship, a two-way relationship. Not just what God does, but how they respond. We've got the timing right. They're saved for obedience. But we need to explore a little bit more how this obedience, what it means and how's it to be expressed. And here I want to go back to chapter 19, which, to put it in a way that even you can understand, chapter 19 is before chapter 20. That is, before God gives the commands, he asks them to make a commitment. So in chapter 19, verse 4, God says to Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. It's a great description of what God has done, isn't it? Carried you on eagle's wings. I presume you've got an image in your mind of, you know, maybe a boy having a ride on an eagle, out of danger to safety. Well, that's what God has done for Israel. And then he says in verse 5, now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you'll be my treasured possession. I presume some of you are thinking there, you're clever enough to sit there and think, hold on, God hasn't told them yet what his commands are. He hasn't given them the conditions of the covenant. But he's saying to them now, before he gives them, will you be in it? Will you obey me? Will you commit yourself to this covenant? God calls them to commit themselves to him as their God, as their Lord and King, before he gives them the details of their responsibility, their response. And Israel respond in a way that shows they think that's appropriate. In verse 7, Moses went back and summoned the elders and told them what God said. And the people of Israel said, "We will do everything the Lord has said." That is, they commit themselves to being God's people before they've got the Ten Commandments. They don't say to God, "God, actually, we'd like to examine them first, please. We want to see what the details are before we sign on to this. I want all the details. I want all the fine print." No, they just say, "Yes, we'll be in it." And then God tells them what it's going to mean in the detail. That is, they get that obedience is a necessary part of any relationship with God. To be God's people involves being in a relationship, a personal relationship with the living God. And to be in that relationship involves an unconditional commitment to obey God, to please him. And so God calls on them to do that before he gives them the commands. That is, there's a macro choice to be made, a big choice to be made. It's not just a little choice now and then to be made. Will I do this? Will I do that? Will I keep that law or won't I keep that law? Now, much before that, before we get to any of the details, there's a heart choice to be made. Do you want God to be your God or not? And God is not a cuddly mascot. He's God. And one of the great dangers for us, I think, is that some of us want to be Christian. We realise that Jesus has died for us. He offers us forgiveness. And we want that. We want it desperately. We really appreciate how generous God has been. But when you accept that forgiveness, you're committing yourself to live under God. You can't keep your options open and day by day look at what God might want you to be and what pleases God and say, "Oh, well, I like that one, I don't like that one. If it doesn't resonate with me, I reserve the right to opt out." Now, to become a Christian, if you like, it's more like getting married than deciding to live together. People decide to live together and that's keeping their options open. If they find out the other person doesn't roll their socks up the right way or squeezes the wrong end of the toothpaste, they've got the option to back out. When you get married, you commit yourself up front before you know often which way they use the toothpaste and where they put their socks and all those really significant things. To become a Christian is more like getting married. It's deciding, yes, I want God to be my God. I want to be saved by him. And it's only after I've made that commitment that what he wants me to live like becomes relevant. I'm saved for relationship before I'm saved for obedience, at least the details of obedience. And so that helps us understand the purpose of these Ten Commandments. These are given to Israel. They're not dropped from the sky to everybody on planet Earth. They're given to Israel once Israel have been saved to be God's people. And they've said, "Yes, God, we want to be your people." And God spells out to them in verses 5 and 6 of chapter 19 what that's going to mean. "Then out of all the nations you'll be my treasured possession." My special possession. You have many possessions, but only some of them are special. Some of them, you've got a sentimental value to them. They mean something to you. That's what God is saying. You will be my sentimental value. "Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." These are the words you're to speak to Israel. See, the purpose of these laws, the Ten Commandments, is to help Israel be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, there's a slight translation issue here at the end of verse 5. Literally it says, "Then out of all the nations you'll be my treasured possession because the whole earth is mine." Now, the difference in meaning in the end is rather insignificant. But I think it makes it clearer what God is saying. He's saying he's isolating Israel as his special people. And as his special people, they need to live a certain wholly different way because all the earth is mine. Australia, America, South America, Argentina, South Africa, all the nations of the world, all the peoples of the world belong to God. That's why he's selecting Israel as a special people, to be a holy nation, distinct and separate from every other nation, but also to be a kingdom of priests. Now, what do priests do? Well, priests are always mediators between a God and people. Israel as a whole nation is called to be a mediator, bringing the blessing of God, not just receiving it, but being a conduit of that to all the peoples of the world. It fits in with what God promised Abraham. said to Abraham, I'll make from you a great nation. I'll give them a land. I'll bless them. And through you, I'll bless all the nations of the world. God is working true to form here, calling Israel now to be that nation who by their distinct holiness will bring blessing to all the world. And so the Ten Commandments are to help Israel be that. So let's quickly look at the content. Just a few brief comments. The first thing about the content is that it's very stark. Many of them have no detail. It's just don't murder, don't steal, don't commit adultery. There's no definitions of terms. There's no consequences spelled out. This is not exhaustive. It's the broad brushstrokes. It's the centre, not the whole. But some of them, if you notice, are much longer than others. Did you see that? The second one is much longer, not to make for yourself an image. The fourth one, remember the Sabbath day, that's much longer. And they're the ones that are eccentric, that is, are very different to the peoples around Israel. The first commandment says, they're not to have other gods, but the true and living God. And then he says in the second one, don't make any images of gods. Now, at one level, all that does is reinforce the first one, doesn't it? Don't have Baal, don't have his images around, don't have the Asherah, don't have all those other gods that you could have. But actually, and more importantly, what it's saying is they're not to worship Yahweh, their God, the God who brought them out of Egypt by making an image of him. Because that's what every nation around them did. They made images of whatever gods they thought could help them. It would make Israel very unusual to not have any images of their gods. The Egyptian gods, the Canaanite gods, the Babylonian gods, the Greek gods, the Roman gods were all, well, you had images of them and you used those to help you worship God. You gave devotion to God by your God by showing devotion to the images. But Israel is forbidden because any image you make of the true and living God will always distort the reality. You can't image God and get him right. But there's more to it than that. Have a look at chapter 20, verses 22 and 23. Almost immediately after God gives the Ten Commandments, the Lord said to Moses, verse 22, tell the Israelites this, you've seen for yourselves that I have spoken to you from heaven. Don't make any gods to be alongside me. Don't make for yourself gods of silver or gods of gold. And what God is saying there is, when I came to you and related to you, I didn't come as a visible form. I spoke to you. You heard me, you didn't see me. What does that tell you? What I want you to do is not make an image of me, but listen to what I tell you. Obey what I command you. That is how you worship this God, the true and living God. The early Christians were known as atheists. It's interesting, isn't it? Because unlike every other religion around them, they didn't have any sacred objects. They didn't have anything that they bowed down to. Because the true and living God is one that commands us not to make images of him. The fourth one, on the Sabbath, is also much longer, isn't it? And again, that would make Israel very different, to work 6 days and then rest. None of the other nations around did that. It's a pattern of living. That means that life is not all about work, 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 work. Like God rested and enjoyed the fruit of his work, so God gives to Israel the blessing of rest. But many of the others are simply tautologies. They're just obviously and by definition, true. God says, do not murder. He doesn't say don't kill. It's a different word. There are many places where God sanctions killing. He says, don't murder. What's murder? Well, the word simply means killing when you shouldn't. Wrongful killing. So what he's saying is, don't do what is wrong. Don't do what you already know is wrong. Don't commit adultery. That is, don't have wrong sex. Don't steal. Don't take something that you shouldn't take. They're all obviously right. There's no room to move in a sense. They're just tautologies. They're self-evidently right. God didn't need to tell them that stealing was wrong. Everybody knows it's wrong. Everyone knows murder is wrong. What the command does is with all the authority of God, God says, don't do it. You know not to do it. You know it's wrong. Don't do it. One clear effect of that is that it makes this sort of wrongdoing sin against God. So if I steal your backpack, it's a sin against you, isn't it? And you could say, well, that's all it is, really. It's quite simple. I'm just sinning against you. But when God says, don't steal, I'm now sinning against God. In stealing your backpack, I have sinned against the God who created me. That ups the stakes remarkably. We can easily minimise something like stealing. Well, you know, they can afford it. It's just a big corporation. They've made many movies. What's wrong with me stealing it from them? But it's against God, not just against them. He's banned it. Although they're tautologies, they're not arbitrary. But as you reflect on these commands and what they tell us to do and not do, it shows us the sort of things that God protects and creates, things that are precious to God. Human life is precious to God. Family life is precious to God. The family life depends at one level on the skill and the love of parents, but actually it depends even more on the willingness of children to honour their parents. If you want to decimate a society, just get all the kids to dishonour their parents, to ignore their parents, to have no respect for their parents. And from year whatever, up to you and beyond, it'll just create complete chaos and anarchy, won't it? That's what our teachers complain of, that the children they try and teach don't know how to respect their parents, let alone anybody else. Society falls apart, but especially families fall apart. Marriage falls apart if adultery is rife. Justice is decimated if people can perjure themselves and tell fibs in court. See, all this is part of God's design. Why don't murder? Well, God has created humans in his own image. They're precious to him. God created man and woman for marriage, in which children are brought up and nurtured in the love and security of a home. See, unlike pagan gods, Yahweh, the God of Israel, cares deeply about us humans. 7 of the 10 commands are about human life, are about human flourishing. If you like, in the 10 commandments, God bears his heart. He shows us what he cares about, what matters to God. Now, that's always a risky thing to do, isn't it? You ever been scared to bear your own heart to somebody else? Because they can take advantage of it, can't they? If they know you hate spiders, what can they do? They can put spiders in your backpack. As soon as they know what you really care about, or what you're frightened of, what you love, what you hate, they can make life hell for you. But they can also please you. And so God, as he gives the Ten Commandments, bears his heart to Israel. They now know how to please God, but also, potentially, how to hurt God. Jesus summarised the Ten Commandments in Luke chapter 10 by saying, you could pull it together by saying, love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength and mind, and your neighbour as yourself. So these commands, in a sense, are just border markers. But they have a positive rationale under them, behind them, fueling them. Love for God and love for each other. Well, there's something about the Ten Commandments. Let's think about the Ten Commandments and us then. Because what we've seen is the Ten Commandments were given to Israel for Israel. The Ten Commandments were central to a covenant that God makes with Israel. But I'm not an Israelite. I'm not living under that old covenant, but under the new covenant in Jesus' blood. So what do I do with these Ten Commandments and the law that they're the heart of? Well, let me make 4 points. This is not exhaustive, but I hope they'll be helpful. The first thing to say is the shape of our relationship with God is exactly the same as the shape of Israel's relationship with God. The new covenant doesn't mean that the old covenant was a total stuff-up from God, and he's finally come to his senses and he's thought, ah, man, I shouldn't have gone that direction at all. I need something new. I know what I'll do. I'll send Jesus, we'll have a new covenant, and we'll try and forget that we ever had the old covenant. No, the old covenant shape of relationship is exactly the same for us under the new covenant. That is, we've been saved for doing good, not saved by doing good. Ephesians chapter 2, I hope, is a passage familiar to many of us. It's by grace, God's grace, you've been saved through faith. Not from ourselves, it's the gift of God. Not by works, so that no one can boast. God saves us purely by grace, not because of anything that we do. But verse 10 is critical as well. For we are God's handiwork, God's workmanship. God's made us, created in Christ Jesus, to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. Why did God save us? Why did God go to that incredibly painful trouble of sending his son to die for us? not just to rescue us from slavery, but to bring us into a friendship, a relationship of doing good, so we would live lives of real goodness and obedience as his people, doing the will of God from the heart. So what this is saying is, if every situation you find yourself in, there is a good work to do that God's already prepared for you. There's never a situation where you can't do good. It may take enormous compassion or extraordinary courage. It may be very costly, but there is good work to do. So we don't do God's will to earn salvation, but because we're saved. Second thing to say is that the law is good. What it prohibits is evil, what it commands is good. But you can misuse the law. So this is 1 Timothy chapter 1. Paul says, we know that the law is good if one uses it properly. We also know the law is made not for the righteous, but for lawbreakers and rebels, the ungodly and sinful, the unholy and irreligious, for those who kill their fathers or mothers, for murderers, for the sexually immoral. Can you hear the Ten Commandments here? Those who kill their fathers and mothers rather than honour them, for murderers, for the sexually immoral and the homosexuals, for slave traders, that is, who steal people, and liars and perjurers. The Ten Commandments are behind this, but notice what he says. The law can be misused, because the law isn't for righteous people, so that they can tick off and feel self-satisfied that they've kept the law. It's for the lawbreakers and rebels, the irreligious. See, who is don't steal for? Well, it's for people who are stealing. It's for robbers and kidnappers to stop them in their tracks. God hates stealing, so stop doing it. But the person who loves their neighbour, they don't need to be told don't steal. They're too busy working for their neighbour's good to help them to steal from them. Notice too, at the end of this, he says, all these actions are contrary to the sound doctrine that conforms to the gospel of Jesus. Evil is contrary to sound doctrine. The commands of God are derived from God's creation design. It conforms as well with the gospel of Jesus, the good news of what Jesus has done for us. Law is just spelling out the implications that you could work out from sound doctrine. Thirdly, the law is toothless. That is, it hasn't got the power you might think it does have. The law doesn't have the power to stop me sinning, to help me to live a good and righteous life. It's the wrong tool to fight sin. That is Paul in Romans 7. Once I was alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin sprang to life and I died. I found that the very commandment that was intended to bring life actually brought death. For sin, and he sees sin almost like a personal power within us, seizing the opportunity that the commandment gave, deceived me, and through the commandment brought me death. So you might think, God's commands, that surely they're going to bring me life. They're going to bring good things. No, they actually have the opposite effect. They provoke and incite me to sin, and then they expose my sin for what it really is, transgression against the living and true God. See, to fight my sin with law is like trying to fight a tiger with a tabby cat. Now, you come across a nice, big, cuddly tiger in a cage somewhere, and you think, I don't really know what this tiger's like. I know what I'll do. I'll throw a cat in there. Well, as soon as you throw the cat in there, you'll find out exactly what the tiger's like. And so will the cat, unfortunately. It'll incite the tiger to show its hunger, and it will show just how quick and strong and deadly it is as the cat gets munched. See, to use law as a tool to help me live a righteous life is like trying to conquer the tiger with a cat. It's toothless. It's useless. What I need is not rules to keep, but a new heart produced by the Spirit, fed and fueled by God's grace. So another way of saying this is, law is a shadow of the good thing, the reality that came in Jesus. These things, festivals, Sabbath days, are a shadow of the things that were to come. The reality comes in Jesus. It's obviously true of things like the sacrificial system. It was a shadow that pointed us to Jesus and his death on the cross as a sacrifice for our sin. And that means we mustn't sacrifice now. But it's true of all the law. It's a shadow of the really good life, the righteous life. You can't legislate righteousness. You can't legislate people being eager to do good. No, Law can't do that. It's a shadow of the righteousness. It points to it. Well, Jesus says in Matthew 5, don't think I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I haven't come to abolish them. But notice he says, I've come to fulfil them. Not to just inflict them and impose them on you unaltered, but to fulfil them, to bring about the state of affairs in which the purpose of the law is fulfilled. The law is a shadowy pointer to real goodness. So how do we live as God's people today? Not by creating a whole long list of commands, the Ten Commandments and all the others we can find in the Bible, and setting out to scrupulously keep them, but instead by setting out to love God and love my neighbour in the power of the Spirit, informed by sound doctrine, which includes the law. That's how we're to do it.